Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 126, recorded Monday, January 16th, 2017. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: beating the traffic and having to think about carry-on luggage. Well, coming to you from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, hoping that everyone had a Merry Christmas or Happy Christmas if you're on the other side of the Atlantic, a Happy Hanukkah, and a Happy New Year. I'm personally trying to do a combo dryish and sugar-free January in an attempt to drop 10 pounds of holiday weight that managed to sneak on board. The downside, I guess, of staying off the road for the back half of December. I eased back into travel mode with my usual Charlottesville trip the first workday of the new year. That would be the third. I didn't really mind it too much since Charlottesville was about 20 degrees warmer than Chicago. It was nice to walk outside with just a scarf and a tweed jacket. Between the last episode and my Christmas break, I did almost as much driving as I did flying. I drove down to Nashville the Friday after Thanksgiving to see my mother. That drive wasn't so bad. The drive back to Chicago, though, was a whole nother matter. Then that next week, I had meetings in Richmond, Virginia, Baltimore, and back down in Charlottesville. I didn't even bother to look at the flight schedules. I knew nonstop Richmond to BWI and BWI to Charlottesville flights. Nonstops were just non-existent, and the sort of two and a half hour drive time was well within my flyer drive tipping point. Neither drives were bad. I mean, the only hassle was the Hertz rental car. Since it was a one-way rental, I was picking up in Richmond and then dropping off in Charlottesville. They gave me a beater car, you know, typical, and it was an older Jeep Patriot that I think was the only car on their lot without Bluetooth, which made listening to podcasts or doing phone calls a bit less convenient. It did give me a chance to explore Baltimore and Charlottesville a bit more than usual, though. On my past visits, I wouldn't even bother with a rental, would just taxi in from the airport and then walk or Uber to places. But with the beater Jeep, I could wander with a bit more range. And in Baltimore, I drove around the Fells Point neighborhood, ended up in the Thames Street Oyster House, then threaded through some of the waterfront areas that I had been a bit hesitant to walk through. In Charlottesville, I wandered through the countryside until I found Star Hill Brewery. It was kind of empty on a rainy Wednesday night, which meant the bartender had time to take me through a flight of her favorite beers. I don't know, between those two, maybe I've found the source of a few of those extra holiday pounds. Following up, I've talked a couple of times in the past episodes about the benefits of buying a pay-as-you-go SIM when traveling internationally. You know, 20 bucks for a gig of data versus AT&T's 60 bucks for 300 megabytes of data. That's just easy math. The only hassle, though, is buying the SIM. First, you got to find the phone store, which can be a bit of an Easter egg hunt. Back in November, our first day in Italy was in Pisa. We land, get in the car, and then head to the city center to find the phone store. However, the easiest one to get to was closed at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Luckily, the next closest one was only about a 10-minute walk, and it was open. This time, for this trip, I'd done my research before we left. I'd purchased the SIMs online and had printed out vouchers with barcodes and instructions in English and Italian. So I was ready, I thought, for a quick and easy transaction. And yet again, I was wrong. The clerk knew nothing about the vouchers, didn't know how to process them, and had to call around to other shops to figure it out. And then, when she finally figured that out, each of the SIMs had to be registered and activated. So over an hour later, so much for quick and easy, we're just sprinting out of the shop so we can make our time slot into the Leaning Tower, which we had also prepaid. This is a pretty typical experience. Searching out the phone store, waiting the hour, click, 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 which is why I was really excited when a telecoms industry consultant told me that the virtual SIM or the eSIM was getting close to launch. Now, Apple took a first crack at that back in 2014, but it's been a slow ramp up. I mean, the iPhone 7 that I picked up back in September still has the classic, AT&T SIM. But this guy was telling me that going SIM-less is just about possible. He said it'll be like signing on to a Wi-Fi hotspot. The next time I land in Italy, turn my phone on, I'll be presented with a sign-in screen where I can select my carrier and plan and charge it to my credit card. Now, given how wonky some Wi-Fi gateways are in airports, I'm not sure that was the best comparison to sell me on the service. But I tell you, if it saves me a couple of hours of frustration when I'm at my most jet-lagged, I'll figure it out. My age odometer clicked over again last month in December, which I guess is a good thing, because if it didn't click over, I'd be dead. So unless I find that Dorian Gray portrait at a garage sale, getting older is better than the alternative. I try not to let it bother me, with varying degrees of success. One thing, though, that does frustrate me is the need to bring my glasses into hotel bathrooms with me, because it seems just as my reading vision is deteriorating, hotels are reducing the type size on their shampoo and conditioner bottles. As they try to go upscale with their toiletries, the bottle designers are taking the regular-sized fancy labels, into Photoshop and then, grabbing the corner and then shrinking them down to fit on the front of a much smaller bottle, resulting in just minuscule type that I might have been challenged to read in my 20s, let alone now. So my drill is to wear my glasses into the bathroom, figure out which bottle is the shampoo, which is the conditioner, and which is the soap or shower gel, whatever they're calling it, and then line them up in intended order of usage on the soap dish in the shower. Then I take my glasses off, turn on the water, and hope that my lined up bottles don't fall. Or at least if they do fall, they fall in the same sequence. The Hyatt Place that I stay at in Charlottesville is one of the few that doesn't require this drill. They have a big number one printed on the shampoo. It runs about 3/4 of the length of the bottle, and a big number two printed on, you got it, the conditioner. And they're in different colors. No need for glasses there. I got to tell you, I love this hotel. You know, it's accepted wisdom that the most disgusting place on an airplane is the seat back pocket, and it just keeps getting worse. As airlines try and tighten up their ground turns, how long a plane is on the ground before it takes off again, the amount of time that the cabin cleanup crew has to do its job continues to shrink. I was reminded of this by a Chicago Tribune article right before Thanksgiving, when many airport workers, cabin cleaners, baggage handlers, wheelchair attendants, had threatened to strike during that busiest of travel weeks. The reporter interviewed a cabin cleaner who had recently moved to Chicago from San Juan, Puerto Rico. She said her crew of four are given 7 minutes to clean the cabin, nowhere near enough time to clean up all the crumbs, spilled drinks, and wrappers ground into the carpet, let alone time to clean the junk people leave in the seat back pocket. The best quote, "I don't know what's wrong with passengers nowadays." I got to tell you, I won't even pull out the safety card when I'm sitting in the exit row anymore. This whole thing reminds me, a buddy of mine told me a story about flying Tunis Air from Brussels to Tunis many years ago. After the meal service, when people were done eating, they just shoved their trays just straight into the seat back pocket. I got to tell you, from the looks of it, I'm not sure it's all that different today. And hey, if you've got any thoughts, questions, a story, comment, travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address, as always, is comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment if you would like to hear your voice. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, and a number of you do. Thank you very much. Or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or go old school. Post them on a website, believe it, a website at travelcommons.com. First topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is beating the traffic. As I mentioned earlier, I've done a bunch of travel lately. I talked in the last episode about driving through Tuscany. I was pleasantly surprised when Hertz upgraded us to an Alfa Romeo sports car, but when we had to drive through the rutted dirt back roads outside of Greve and Chianti, I was left wanting for something with a bit more ground clearance. The Thanksgiving drive down to Nashville was a lot smoother. I mean, they'd finally finished the years of construction, expanding the I-80, I-94 constriction point. It's a huge choke point that comes around Lake Michigan in northwest Indiana. And the traffic from there, then on I-65 south, flowed pretty smoothly. Actually, we made good enough time to make a couple of beer stops in Columbus, Indiana, at the new Upland Brewing restaurant, and then in downtown Louisville at Against the Grain Brewing. So, you know, that was a nice couple of stops there. But the drive back to Chicago was a whole nother matter, and I knew it and I dreaded it. We drove down that Friday, just like I said, sailing through downtown Indy, Louisville, Nashville, because, of course, everybody was on vacation or shopping. It was Black Friday. Driving back Sunday, though, we were right in the thick of the busiest travel day in the U.S. And while I always avoid flying on that Sunday, I'd managed to put us, you know, on one of the U.S.'s main north-south interstates. You know, it would have only been worse if we'd been on the East Coast driving I-95 or the Jersey Turnpike. And it was the beatdown that I'd expected. Now, the drive out of Nashville was fine, and it was kind of pretty going through the rolling hills up to Louisville. The traffic was steady, but it was flowing. But we were, you know, we kept picking up more traffic as we headed north. We took a break in Indy this time, stopping off at Sun King Brewing right off the interstate, and then sort of coffeed up at a nearby Starbucks. North of Indy, though, was when it really hit. More and more cars and trucks heading up to Chicago, but still just two lanes heading north. And so when the inevitable accident happened, as it did many times that Sunday, closing down one of those lanes, cutting the already clogged road by 50%, the travel app Waze became, if not a lifesaver, then a time saver. Now, I was running three nav systems kind of in parallel, Waze, Google Maps, and the in-dash BMW nav system. Now, all had real-time traffic, but Waze seemed to be the quickest in sensing the need for a reroute. A couple of times that Sunday, it would direct us to take the next exit after traffic had stopped and would vector us around the bottleneck and back onto the interstate, saving us easily 15, 20 minutes of crawling and, I got to think, at least 70 points of increased blood pressure. I did skip the recommended diversion, though, through the south side of Chicago. Given the record number of shootings in Chicago this past year, stop-and-go traffic didn't seem to be quite the burden that it did in rural Indiana. The next week's triangulation across Richmond, Baltimore, and Charlottesville found me on I-95, having to make two passes around Washington, D.C. on the Capitol Beltway, which is always a brutal eight-lane choke point running up the East Coast. So heading up from Richmond that Tuesday night, Google Maps told me to take sort of the clockwise west route around D.C., while Waze told me to go east. Now, it's kind of odd since Google owns both of these applications. A friend of mine told me that he had researched this a bit. He'd noticed the differences, researched it, and found some articles claiming that Waze's algorithm weighs sort of current information, and Google Maps tends to weigh more historical trends. I don't know if any of this is true. I have not been able to find anything that says this, and I've looked. But I often see different rush hour recommendations between Waze and Google Maps. And so you got to make a call, and since Waze served me well on Thanksgiving Sunday, I went east and took the counterclockwise path around. It was a rainy night, but the traffic flowed better than I had expected, and I made it to Baltimore in time for that oyster dinner at Fells Point. In spite of juggling nav apps, I found that I was more productive driving from Richmond to Baltimore to Charlottesville than I would have been flying. You'd think it would be the other way around, but the lack of direct flights would have meant going up and down and connecting through Washington Dulles. And on those few minutes that I might have been able to work on the plane, full planes and tight seats make it seem, I don't know, it's starting to feel almost antisocial to try and open up a laptop, especially on a regional jet. On my three-hour drive from Baltimore to Charlottesville, though, I was able to sort of hammer through two conference calls and an unhurried, sort of wide-ranging conversation with my boss. He called me. I told him I was having a nice drive through Virginia horse country, and his response was, "Good. I have you captive." Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is having to think about carry-on luggage. I got to tell you, I don't normally think a lot about packing or luggage, and sometimes I think that puts me in the minority of frequent travelers. I know guys who obsess over their Tumi bags and sort of specific packing systems. I used a gray Samsonite roller until the New Orleans sidewalks beat the wheels out to a 30-degree splay, and then I went back to my old black, Victorinox with custom stickers from Thailand and Vietnam from 2008. However, a few things in 2016 got me thinking about carry-ons. My carry-on experience with WOW Air in Iceland that I talked about in an earlier episode, where I had to pull out half my clothes to meet the weight restrictions. And then my daughter's light blue carry-on that was seeming to catch the eye of every gate agent she tried to pass. And then being forced to check it, having it end up being lost 75% of the time. And then most recently, enduring some long and often cold waits on a jet bridge waiting for my quote-unquote valet-checked carry-on bag when flying regional jets to places like Charlottesville. We're starting from the bottom up. I got to tell you, this regional jet thing just kills me. It used to be that gate checking for a commuter flight wasn't a big deal. I mean, actually, it was a great deal. The bag would be waiting for you on the jet bridge just before you got off the plane. Now, as regional jets, right, no longer commuter jets, but regional jets have gotten larger, they put the gate-checked luggage in the same hold with the regular checked luggage. I mean, the only differentiating factor being the tag they put on it at the gate. I mean, I'm typically waiting around 10 minutes with 40 to 50 other passengers lined up on one side of an unheated, in the winter, unair-conditioned in the summer, jet bridge, leaning over, and all of us are leaning over, so it's like a bad Rockettes or a bad Esther Phillips swim movie, leaning over to see if our bags had come. It's just gotten really bad. Now, on some of the larger Embraer jets flown by JetBlue, I've seen some on American, the overhead bins are large enough for regular bags. But on most of the regionals, you're standing in that jet bridge. After a while, this got really old. So I scrounged around through the old luggage in the attic to find a smaller duffel for sort of the one or two night trips and that I could then fit in that small overhead. I found a black nylon duffel from a 2007 National Retail Foundation tech conference that was an attendee giveaway. I mean, it had all the sponsors' names stenciled across it, Oracle, Infosys. I don't know, I kind of felt like a NASCAR racer carrying it, but it did the job. I could squish it into the small overheads and so walk past the folks waiting for the valets to bring their luggage. But it still looked a little cheesy. So when I was in Italy in November, I kept my eye out for a nice leather bag. And one rainy day in Florence, which unfortunately was not unique on that trip, we dove into a covered outdoor market just to get out of the rain. And wandering through the stalls, I found a really nice leather bag for about 100 euros. And my wife then pointed to the bag next to it, the next size up. She said, "Don't you want a bigger one? It's only 20 euros more." It's like, nope. That would defeat the whole purpose. Actually, I posted a picture of that bag on Twitter, and every time I walk up the O'Hare jet bridge when returning home from Charlottesville on that regional jet, I love that bag even more. I remember when I first started traveling, I'd never see a hard-sided carry-on. Now it seems at least, 30% of the carry-ons are hard-sided. I think a lot of it is fashion. I mean, they come in much cooler designs and colors, but there is some functionality to them. If you're flying an airline that's aggressively using a baggage sizer, it's much easier to stay legal with a hard-sided bag. I mean, you can't overstuff them to bulging like you can a soft-sided bag. And the polycarbonate shell kind of slips easier in and out of that metal baggage sizer, which is why I suggested to my daughter that she start using a hard-sided bag and in a bit more muted colors. You know, not like the light blue or the leopard print, you know, the leopard print, something that wouldn't quite grab the gate agent's eye. But if you're working against weight limits as well as dimensions, like I was with Wow Air, you want the lightest, most stripped-down bag possible. That's funny. I haven't experienced a carry-on weight limit in the U.S. A lot of the U.S. carriers don't even post a weight limit, just a size limit. Some of the U.S. carriers that do post a limit, it's like 35 to 40 pounds. I mean, even Spirit is at 40 pounds, but I've never seen a gate agent actually weigh a carry-on. I mean, I've had some of them tell me, "Look, we don't have a weight limit. You just got to be able to get the bag up in the overhead by yourself." The international carriers are where this weight limit comes in. Wow Air's carry-on size dimensions are about the same as U.S. carriers, but their weight limit is much less, 10 kilograms or 22 pounds, so maybe about a third of the, or maybe two-thirds of the U.S. limit. And that 10 kilos, 22 pounds seems like the consensus number for non-U.S. carriers. And in this case, though, you don't want the extra weight of hard siding. You probably don't even want very sturdy wheels. Just the lightest covering that you can get to surround your clothes is what you want. It's funny, I know guys who will brag that they can fit everything they own into two suitcases. Well, they're obviously not doing it on international carry-on. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons Podcast number 126. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed or even tell other people about it. Check out the show notes for music links. You can always find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher. I don't know about Google Play with the new podcast capabilities. I keep getting a goofy error about picture size, so I don't know if that shows up. But anyhow, and you can always find it on the website at travelcommons.com. There's always a button there that you can push. You know, more recent episodes will play on SoundCloud, and then kind of older back editions end up will just play just off the website right there. So anyhow, a lot of places that you can find current or past issues of the Travel Commons podcast. And remember, if you have a story, thought, gripe, comment, moans, groans, cries of anguish, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comment, comments at travelcommons.com or to mpeacock on Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons Facebook, I don't know, wall, site, page, whatever they call it, or post them to the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks for everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, hit me on Twitter, post comments on the website, leave comments on the Facebook page. It's great. I always appreciate the help with the content. So I hope again that everyone is having a great new year. Until we talk again, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.